Holly.
Hey, Dave.
What is going on with yourself today on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
Dave, this might feel like the first time that we have talked to a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominee, but it isn't. Does it feel like the first time to you?
Well, every time feels like the first time. We are talking with Rick Wills, the bassist of Foreigner. Yay! We're hoping Foreigner gets in there. They are one of the current nominees. It's the exciting time when you get to vote. Vote early, vote often. How many do they allow you to vote, like once a day?
Yes, I believe they do.
Did you vote today, Holly?
I did vote today.
Okay. Was it vote.rockhall.com? The reason we are talking to Rick is because he is plugging his band. This is a guy who came on board during Head Games, the third Foreigner album. So Foreigner was big with their first two records. And then the third one was a disappointment because it only sold 5 million copies. And then they went through, the next album was Four, and they went through the stratosphere. They started having number one hits, and they never looked back. So Foreigner's prime time was with Rick Wills in the lineup, for sure. He had a great career with Peter Frampton, the first three records. He wrote this song. I don't know if you know this, Holly. Did you know the song, Do You Feel Like We Do? Have you heard of this song by Peter Frampton?
Rick Wills co-wrote this hit with Peter Frampton.
That's nice. That's like winning the lottery right there. You're done. I would be done. What a great career. I'm done. Okay, see you later. I'm going to just live off the riches right here. I don't need to play anymore.
As Rick tells the story, it is kind of like winning the lottery. So stay tuned for that story.
And stay tuned for our social media updates, Holly. What can they find on the social media pages of What Difference Does It Make?
So check us out on YouTube at What Difference Does It Make Podcast and on all our other social media at WDDIM Podcast. And you will find outtakes from this chat with Rick and many of our other interviews.
That sounds great. Let's get right into it right now. We are talking with Rick Wills. He's pushing Foreigner for the Rock Hall. Vote now. But first, listen to the podcast and then vote. Actually, do it twice. Let's get into it. Rick Wills of Foreigner on the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Hi.
Hey.
Rick. How you doing?
Good.
Nice to see you.
Okay, so you're clearly not in a hotel room unless you bring those records with you everywhere you go.
No, I'm in my house in Florida.
Okay, so okay.
No, I don't carry them around with me. They're here stuck on the wall. But I like showing them off because they mean a lot to me.
Yeah, oh, I bet.
You should if I had them. In fact, we should have a fake background with some gold records.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, so that actually answers our first question. Holly and I were talking about, are you a member of Foreigner right now?
Yes, I am still, yes. Basically, what we did was, although we broke up, in 92, when Lou did his solo album and stuff, we kind of stayed in touch with each other, even though I went off and joined Bad Company for the next 10 years. You know, I like to work, basically, and I didn't want to be sitting around twiddling my thumbs. So I joined Bad Company because I knew the guys. I knew Mick Rouse and Simon Kirk pretty well, and it was great. I mean, because, you know, I love their music. Why wouldn't you? I mean, come on. It's a great band. So I just kept in touch, and, you know, we crossed paths, obviously, you know, in the years that went by. And then we got round to sort of 2016-17, and we were starting to talk about the 40th anniversary of the bands being Foreigner. And quite honestly, you know, I mean, we still think today, we have to pinch ourselves to think that we're still relevant 50 years nearly after it was started by Mick Jones. And it is hard to believe. But, you know, I go to shows from time to time, and I will be doing more this year. I do promise our fans that. And so will Al Greenwood, and I hope Dennis Elliott. Mick, unfortunately, because of his Parkinson's and, you know, illness factor, and Lou's had some issues as well, as you probably know, it's a little more difficult for them. But we're hoping that we get inducted. We're looking good vote-wise at the moment. So we're asking everyone we speak to please vote for us every day because it really counts. I just can't believe that Dave Matthews just shot by us by about 30,000 votes.
I was about to say.
How did that happen?
They've got an insane fan base.
Listen,
the jam bands.
It's all fair play. It's all fair play. We overtook Ozzy Osbourne yesterday by a few votes, you know, 1,000 or two or three. And that was we just thought that wasn't possible. And now we're in second place and Ozzy's in third. Peter Frampton's in fourth. Now, you know, Peter and I obviously, as you probably know, worked together back in the early 70s. And I did about 3.5-4 years with him. And I learned the ropes of America in those days. Boy, did we learn the ropes. Because when he left Humble Pie, we had to start from the bottom, work it up, you know, from there. And it was tough. It really was. But it gives you good groundwork for what you learn about doing shows and how competitive it is in America to be a top band. I sure learned that, and I was very glad of it, because when I got the opportunities that came later in life, especially the one with Foreigner, because I've known Mick Jones since 76. I met him in Paris when I was there with David Gilmour. You know, I'm so pleased that we've been finally realized, that people have realized that it was time to bring us into the Hall of Fame. And I hope we do get the votes that we need and we get the votes from the other people. I mean, we've had some help, I will admit, from Mark Ronson, who is Mick's stepson. He's done a lot of very nice things for us with the videos, with Dave Grohl, Slash, and people. And then there was, of course, you've probably seen the Paul McCartney one.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. I've never seen Paul curse on anything ever. Yeah, he did.
Foreigner, not in the Hall of Fame. What the fuck?
I mean, it was hilarious, you know, to him to say what he said. I mean, I've known Paul quite a while. Well, he's a good friend of Mick's. And, you know, he's a very, very genuinely nice guy, Paul, too. I mean look, I admire him so much. How can you not? He's a Beatle, for goodness sake. Whenever I've been in his presence, I still have to pinch myself and say, it's Paul McCartney. Oh, my God, he's a Beatle. You know, it's weird. But that's the fact of life. You know, the Beatles came along and they just blew us all away. And it continues to do so. They're so talented. Paul, he's in his 80s now, and he's still doing three-hour shows. It's incredible. I mean, the energy that guy has got, I admire him so much. I love his bass playing. I love everything about him.
Well, is it Paul that made you pick up a bass? Or what was your first?
No.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. It was much earlier than that, really. I was about 12, 13 when I wanted to play the guitar. Because there was a band in England called The Shadows, who were Cliff Richard's backing group. And I thought they were the best thing since sliced bread. I mean, they were just brilliant as a band and as people. I've been lucky enough to work with Bruce Welch and met all the guys in the band. That's what I wanted to do. I thought, I want to be up on that stage one day, as good as they are. So I had a goal in mind. I mean, unfortunately, school went out the window at that point for me. I just lost interest totally. I mean, I was terrible. I really didn't want to go to school hardly. I just wanted to play guitar. And I did for a couple of years in local bands in Cambridge where we live. I could never get the hang of lead guitar work. I could play chords and I was a good rhythm guitarist. But the bass always attracted me. And I thought, I really would love a Fender Precision bass. And I finally convinced my mother to do it and get me one on hire purchase, you know, because it was tough. My dad was a carpenter and joiner by trade. He didn't earn a lot of money, but I thought, well, one day I'll earn more than he does. And I did. Mastering his annoyance.
Paying back for the bass.
Yeah. I mean, I just love the bass playing. I love being with the rhythm section with the drummer. I've been lucky enough to play with some great drummers, you know, all my life, with Kenny Jones, you know, Dennis Elliott, you name it, Simon Kirk. They're fabulous drummers, all of them, in different ways. I just like being that anchor in the band. Let the lead guitarist show off and let the singer be his front man, whatever. But I like just making that sound rich and full, because that's why I think they chose me in the end. I'm always a guy who wants a big, round bass sound. Whereas Ed Gagliardi had a very trebly Rickenbacker sound. And I think that sort of kind of, I think they thought about it. And I know that Lou came to the point where he said, well, I think we really ought to make a change. And I happened to be in New York at the time, which was just pure luck, because I co-wrote two songs with Peter on that live album, Do You Feel Like We Do, probably his biggest song ever. And a song called Doobie Wah, a tribute to the Doobie Brothers, who we worked with quite a lot on the West Coast of America.
So Peter Frampton famously, like when he learned, he's like, I'm not in it already. He's probably going to play some songs that you played on originally. Would you be on that Rock Hall stage with Peter? Is that a possibility?
Well, I've run the idea past him, put it that way. He hasn't given me a yes or no yet.
Okay.
But I said, I'd really like to do You Feel Like We Do again, Peter. But the trouble is, he's expanded it now. It's like 20 minutes long on stage. When we cut that first track, it was 3 minutes long. I mean, it was just a simple idea. Peter had the riff that do-do-do-do-do-do. I just went dum-dum-dum. And that got the feel of it together. And then we sort of just worked on it and got the track organized. And then he wrote the lyric. That was in 1971, I believe, when we did that. It's a long time ago. Well, when that album came out, I mean, it just was ridiculously popular. It was so big. Because we worked America for all those years beforehand, Peter, you know, was known for what he did as a live artist, and rightly so. Great guitar player. I was at the time, I'd just finished work with the Small Faces, and I really didn't have a lot to do at the moment at home. And my wife said, Rick, why don't you call up Dee Anthony, Peter's manager in New York, and find out what's going on with the album? And I did that. And he said, Rick, you're owed a lot of money. We can't keep up with this. He said, it's just gone millions after millions. I think it was 18 million records sold in America alone of the Peter Frampton Comes Alive. Biggest live album ever. So I bought myself a standby ticket on TWA, and I flew to New York to stay with my friend Jerry Shirley, the drummer of Humble Pie, who I've known many, many years. In fact, he was our best man at our wedding for my wife. So I stayed with him for a couple of days, went to see Dee, sat in his office, and I said, what's going on, Dee? He said, it's just gone nuts. It's totally crazy. I can't believe this that's happened. I said, well, am I owed any money? He said, oh, Rick, you're owed a lot of money. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, I can give you a check today because we're still doing the accounting on this, the whole thing. It's just so big. I said, oh, that would be wonderful, dear. I said, I could really do with some money right now. He wrote me a check that day for $35,000 cash. I mean, can you believe that? That's more money than I'd ever had at that time. This is 1979, the beginning of 79. I went back to Jerry's house and I told him what had just happened. I said, we're going to party, boy. We're going to go our butts out of here and in that pub and go have a few drinks. And that's what we did for a couple of days. And in that couple of days, we heard that Foreigner had decided to change bass players. And I said, well, can you find Mick's number? I know he has an apartment in New York. Jerry got his number, and I rang him up. I said, mate, it's Rick. He said, oh, I didn't know you were in New York. I said, well, I am. I said, and I'd love to audition for the band because I love what you're doing. He said, do you know this stuff? I said, yeah, I've had your two albums in my car for the last 2 years. I said, I know your songs really well, actually. He said, well, that's great. Have you got a bass? I said, no, but you've got some Fender basses, I know. I said, can I just borrow one? And I'll just come down to the studio. He said, come to SIR Studios and we'll run over a few things with the band. And I hadn't met the other guys in the band, Lou, Dennis, Al, Ian. I just literally went there and I said hi to them all. And they said, what do you want to do? I said, well, you name a song and I'll play it. They said, well, Double Vision. So we did Double Vision. That sounded great. And we did Hot Blooded. That sounded great. Feels like the first time. This feeling of like something was really right about the way we were together. And Dennis just got off his drum kit and walked towards the front where I was standing down on the floor in front of the band playing. And he just walked up and he said, I want Rick in the band in front of everybody. And I just had the biggest stupid grin on my face because I couldn't believe what he was saying. And Mick said, oh, Dennis, no. You can't do that. We've got 70 bass players who want to audition for this job.
You're showing your poker hand too soon, man.
I know. And I said, listen, it's okay. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, just be here for the next 10 or 12 days because then we'll get you back and we'll run over arrangements vocals, you know, all the more technical stuff rather than just playing the song. And I did that, and that went really well too. There was a general feeling that I was doing very well, but they couldn't give me the job. There was somebody, all the best bass players in New York and all over them wanted that job. And you can't blame them. I mean, Foreigner's first two albums were so big, and they had already just gone, wow, boom. You know, they were big time. And I thought, oh, this is just incredible. You know, I thought, well, I'm just going to hang in here. So I called my wife in London, and we had two very young children at the time, a little girl called Nikki, who was 5, and a little boy called Daniel, who was about 18 months. And they both got chickenpox at the same time. My wife said, Rick, please come home. I'm going nuts. I can't cope. This is really difficult. I said, Lynn, how can I leave New York? I said, I'm really close to getting this job. I want it so bad. She said, please, come home. I gave in, and I did. I flew back to London, and I was home for one day, one night. And the next morning, as I was waking up feeling groggy and jet-lagged, the phone rang, and it was Bud Prager, Foreigner's manager, and Mick Jones in the office, asking me how I was feeling. And I said, pretty groggy, actually, guys, to be honest. They said, well, you're going to feel great. I said, well, why? She said, well, you got the job with Foreigner. I went, you've got to be kidding me. I said, this is amazing. Because my wife is in here. We were in bed still, and my kids were on the bed with us. And they were all jumping up and down with excitement because they knew Daddy had just got this incredible job. And I said, this is life-changing. I said, what do you want me to do, guys? I said, we want you to come to New York. I said, when? Today. I said, oh, no. You're kidding me. I said, today. I said, yeah, but we've got to go into rehearsals. We've got to start the new album, which was going to be Head Games. So I literally went to the airport to British Airways desk, and I walked up to the counter, and I talked to the lady. I said, hi, my name's Richard Wills. I think there's a ticket for me to New York. And she looked at me and she just smiled. She said, Mr. Wills, we're very, very sorry, but the Concorde is full today. It's sold out. And I just looked at her. I said, Concorde? I said, I don't go on Concorde. I said, I always sit in the back of the plane. He said, well, not today you don't. I said, well, what's the choice? He said, would you like to sit in first class on a 747? And I could never have been in first class in my life at that point, believe me. I said, would I mind? I don't think I would mind at all. And that's what happened. I mean, literally, they put me in first class on a 747. And in those days, back in 79, upstairs was a lounge area, right, where they had a bar and, you know, comfortable seating where you could just hang out because it was, what, 7.5, 8 hours to New York from London. So I thought, well, that's a good opportunity to go up there and celebrate. I did.
And you did, yeah.
I mean, you've got to do this. So I was telling the crew and, you know, the stewardesses, I said, you know, the reason I'm going to New York is because I'm joining this band called Foreigner. And they said, oh, my God, we love Foreigner. Cold as ice, you know, feels like the first time we know all their songs. So I said, I think we should have a drink. So we out came the wine, right? So I thought to myself, well, look, I'm going to New York. I probably won't arrive till about 6:30 in the evening. I don't think I'll be working today. I'll be okay. I'll have a few drinks, which I did. And I got to New York, picked up my bags, and one of the road crew was there to meet me. And they said, Rick, we're going straight to rehearsal, you know. I said, oh, my God, no, please. I said, I've had way too much to drink on the plane. Take me to a coffee shop immediately. I got to straighten up. He says, no problem. Come on. We said, we've got two big cups of black coffee, strong. And we went straight to SIR Studios again. There was the band waiting to go. And we went straight into Dirty White Boy. Songs that we just had to get ready and be in the studio in a couple of days at Atlantic Studios on Broadway in those days. And it was just amazing to be part of something that was big, really happening, And you, the excitement was incredible. It really was. And that's how I became part of Foreigner.
We're going to take a break and vote for Foreigner for the Rock Hall. You're going to take a break and listen to these messages right now.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our guest, Rick Wills.
So, I mean, you knew old Foreigner stuff. Did you lock in instantly playing Dirty White Boy? Like, okay, I get exactly what's happening. Or did it take like a time? I mean, it's like easy fit right in. You fit right in.
Meant to be.
They didn't tell me what to play. They just said, play as you feel it. That's how I play. You know, I'm not a very technical bass player in such. And I'm not a particularly busy bass player, but what I do is I play with the drummer to get the feel of the song right. And they liked that. They really got it. That's where I was at, the anchor part of the band. I think that's what it worked so well for us. It just went from there. It wasn't anything really hard. We just looked at each other and smiled a lot because why wouldn't you? You know, it was a good feeling. Yeah, it was good. It was really nice.
Did you sing backup too?
Yeah. I like to sing, and I'm lucky. I've got a pretty good range. I can sing a high parts as well as low, so that was also another asset in my favour in a way that I could do the vocals with Lou and Mick out front. And we did that whole year of touring, went all over Europe, went to Japan, which I'd never been to before, and I love Japan. Oh, what a great country to tour in! The culture there is amazing, and I love their food, by the way.
Yeah.
Fans are passionate.
Oh, yeah. And we came back from that tour, and I could feel that Lou and Mick were thinking about things. You know, they thought, well, Head Games had not been such a success as Double Vision had been, partly because a lot of people thought the album cover with the girl in the gent's toilet was offensive. And now I don't understand that personally, because all she was doing, it was called Head Games, remember, rubbing out her name on a wall because of, you know what used to happen in these places. Everybody used to write on walls with a Sharpie. You know, it did really well. I think it did about 3, 4, 5 million albums, which for us at the time was like, you know.
That's insane that was disappointing.
Disappointing compared to the 10, 12 million
sure.
Double Vision.
No, I get that, know. Yeah.
So I could tell that Mick and Lou was thinking about something, but I didn't really know what it was. Because, you know, we came off the road, had a break, and I got a call from Bud Prager, the manager, and he said that Mick and Lou have decided to make a change in the band. And I thought, I'm probably going to be pushed out or something, you know. He said, no, it's not you, Rick, you're staying. I said, what is it? He said, they decided that Ian and Al are going to go. We want to change the way they do things. They want you, Dennis, Lou, and Mick to be the core of the band, to lay down the tracks, but they feel that they want to bring in different people from all over with different ideas to give it different textures and different feels, which is exactly what Mick did. Because he used to go to England a lot to check out the music scene. And we brought in Tom Dolby, people like that, guys from other bands that gave us a whole different perspective, actually, on how to texture and layer things. And I can see what they were getting at after about a few months of working on this album. Because I don't know if you probably know this, but when we went in to do the 4 album with Mutt Lang, who's a brilliant producer, by the way, and the hardest working man ever, we cut Waiting for a Girl Like You in 2 hours. That was the first track we cut, right? And I thought, well, this is a doddle. You know, we're going to do this so quickly. We'll just get this done in a couple of months. Well, we didn't. Because it took over a year to make that album, and it cost a lot of money to do. But in the course of that year, Mutt insisted, and this is not always easy with Mick, because Mick likes to be in charge pretty much of everything. I mean, he's a great musical director. He really is. They clashed heads quite a few times, but Mutt sort of insisted, I want an anthem on this album that's really big and strong, and so became Jukebox Hero. You know, we got it eventually. It wasn't there at first, but we got it.
Did it start with your bass? Because that's like, that's the first thing you hear. Yeah. You feel that bass and you know something's happening. Standing in the rain with his head hung low. Couldn't get a ticket. It was a sold out show. Heard the roar of the crowd. He could picture the scene.
Just left to us to find our own way to do it, you know. But it was tough at times, it really was. And then Mark said, I want something really different. And Mick had this riff for Urgent, like, down, 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 you know. And we didn't have a lyric. And he wrote the lyric in the bathroom, believe it or not. He went to the toilet and came back and said, I've got it. I went, what? He said, I've got the lyric. I said, well, what's it called? He said, Urgent. I said, was it that bad?
Perfect.
You know.
And how did Junior Walker come? I was just a kid. Every time I listened to the radio, they mentioned Junior Walker on sax. I had no idea who Junior Walker was at the time. Now, of course, I know how legendary he is. How did he come into the fold?
Well, we all knew, I mean, because we're older than you guys, obviously, and we were aware of this, all the stuff coming out of America from Memphis and places like that. Junior Walker was a big part of that, and the All-Stars, you know, their music was, very important, all those instrumentals, you know. Bah, bah, bah. Mick went to see him in a club in New York one night. We were actually in the studio at the time. He went, checked him out, and next thing I know, they're all there in the studio with us, Junior Walker and his band. They couldn't believe it. I mean, they went to our fridge where we kept our drinks and our food, and it was full of stuff. You know, it always was, champagne and God knows what. They just fed themselves up because, they weren't earning big money in those days. They really weren't. Junior was, relatively minor by that time, but he was still great. We wanted him to play the solo on Urge because we loved that style, but he kind of lost his way a bit and was playing much more mellow stuff. But we convinced him that he ought to go back to the old way of playing the high notes, all that stuff. And we got it. It took a while to get, but we got it with quite a bit of editing, I might add. That's what you do. but we got the solo that we wanted. Working for this, he was a wonderful, wonderful guy, Billy Joel's musical director, and a keyboard player called Bob Mayo, who worked with Peter Frampton, many, many people. A brilliant keyboard player. He has perfect pitch. If he hears something, he can play it. That's a real gift. So we had all this talent with us, and they all could sing, they could all play. So it worked very well for us to have that band with Mark and Bobby up the back of the stage behind Dennis, us four more or less in the front with Lou, Mick and I at the front of the stage. Well, four just went out the door and just went crazy. I mean, the first single was Urgent and it just took off. I thought people are going to say that's not Foreigner, that's different. But they did, they liked it. And of course, that was followed with Waiting for a Girl Like You that was just a massive hit. Maybe I'm wrong, won't you tell
for a Girl Like You with Thomas Dolby. That was before he released some of his own stuff, but he was known as a technical wizard.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the texture, you know, the intro into Waiting for a Girl Like You is Tom Dolby doing that, those sounds. That was his idea, and we didn't run with it because Mick wanted that. I mean, he's just got this incredible ear, Mick, for hearing something and said, that's what I want. And until he gets that, he's not happy. To get all those textures, that's what a lot of people don't realize in Foreigner's music, what's actually going on within the song.
Was there any pushback? Like, A Girl Like You was the first ballad from Foreigner, and like, is this Foreigner music? I'm sure there was a discussion about that.
Well, you can't push back on a song that good.
Yeah, I well.
Mean, it was the start of something that festered in a way, doing that, because then Mick sort of got into this way of writing more with keyboard, shall we say, more mellow. And it changed our audience slightly too. We noticed there were ladies with silver hair down the front more than the young girl, you know, which is kind of funny for us. You know, it wasn't that way. It used to be crazy. I think that got to Lou a little bit, especially when, you know, One and Only Lovers came along, which he played to me as just a musical idea. And I said, oh, that's a beautiful melody, Mick. That really is. I said, have you got the lyric yet? He said, no, but I'm working on it. So I know Lou has complained at times that he should have had a credit on that, but it is Mick's song, in all honesty. That is totally Mick Jones's work. in that song. I know that because I was there. I recorded it with them and I saw what happened. But these things happen. And I think that was the beginning of Blue thinking, we're going down a road now that's not so rock and roll as I like it to be. I like the more rocking tracks and the more, you know, the Hot Blooded and stuff like that, you know. Eventually, the ballad kind of side of it and the more keyboard stuff, I think that festered in Lou's mind for some time. And also, he was being told by people in the record company, a lot of people saying, well, you're the voice of Foreigner. You know that. You're the one who's really Foreigner in a way. And I think he believed it, probably more than he should have done, because it was a tragedy in a way to end it like that. But when he decided to do the solo thing and leave, well, you can imagine the quandary we were in. How do you replace Lou Grant? As a voice, there isn't many better than him, in my opinion. He's up there with your Paul Rodgers and, you know, all those kind of guys. We didn't really quite know what to do. We tried different people out. Some of them were really good. In fact, we very nearly hired John Waite, actually, to be the singer. And he was good. We worked with him for a week, and he was really good. But Mick had his worry that John was somewhat of a risk somehow. You know, he wasn't sure if that was quite right. So he decided against it. And I thought that was a bit of a mistake, actually. But there you go.
So you were on the other side. You saw John Waite, like, we want you. This is, you're hired.
I mean, I took him back to my house up in Westchester, and he had dinner with us. And I loved him. I thought he was a great guy.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, this year, Foreigner out on tour with Styx and John Waite. So I'm going to be doing some of those shows this year. And I can't wait to see, because I know Styx really well. Because when I was with Bad Company, we did a lot of shows together. Mm-hmm. Tommy Shaw and I became very good friends. And they're a lovely bunch of guys, and they're so good. So I don't know who's going to headline as such on those shows, but I can tell them one thing. It's hard to follow Foreigner when they've done a show, because the current band are so good. I mean, people say, oh, they're covers band. That's not true. They were put there by us. We chose those guys. We chose them individually by their talent and what they gave, because they wanted to do Foreigner right. And not many people can, but they can. So that's why when I sit in with them, we just look at each other and go, this is ridiculous. How can we be like this? This feels like Foreigner. It is. And people still love it. And we're still doing great business. It's a real pleasure to be on that stage with such lovely people who are respectful. They want to play the music correctly and right. And I don't have a problem at all with them doing what they're doing. Kelly's been with the band. Kelly Hansen is a great frontman and a great singer. He's been with the band now 19 years. You know, you can't forget that. That's a long time to keep this thing going. When this nomination came up, we all went, oh, my God, I never thought it was going to happen. I mean, we've been available for 22 years to be nominated.
Who are the members that are going to be inducted? I know it's up to the Rock Hall on who gets in. I'm sure you're in there.
Well, I can tell you for one thing, Dennis Elliott, myself, and Al Greenwood are definitely will be there.
Right.
We hope Mick Jones will be there, because Mick can play keyboards fine now. But because of the Parkinson's, it's difficult for him to play guitar because of the shakiness of his hands and stuff. Lou, he's fine in as much as he can still sing, but he hasn't got the range he used to have. But Kelly has. So we will use a combination of the current band with us to do the show in Cleveland, if we get that far, right? We hope we will. But that's our plan. And Mark Ronson wants to produce it. He wants to be part of it, because he's a very talented boy. I mean, he really is. Can't believe what he's achieved. It's incredible. I've known him since he was a little boy.
I was about to say, was he ever in the studio with you guys?
He was always around. When he says quite openly, how would I be where I am today without Foreigner and what I saw going on around me, because it was nothing but music all day, all night. Now, Mark wants to be involved, and he's been so helpful in getting the story out. I mean, when I saw Dave Grohl sit behind that drum kit and say what he said.
I've loved Foreigner since I got their debut record in 1977, I think, which made me about 8 years old. And that was right around the time that I was starting to learn how to play the drums. And there's one drum riff from the song Feels Like the First Time, which is such a classic drum riff that I have used in more than a few songs over the years. And it sounds like this.
I mean, I love Dave Grohl. I think he's absolutely brilliant, you know, what he's achieved, what he's done. And then I found out he wants to do Hot Blooded with us, you know, on the night. I thought, well, that's all right by me, you know, for sure. I know. He's, I mean, that's what I've heard. I don't know if it's true. And then Slash, of course, you know, I mean, what he said was amazing.
Hey, Slash here. And I just wanted to comment on Foreigner because I'm so happy that they're nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm definitely going to vote for them. Foreigner was one of the great bands of the 70s for sure. You know, they were the background music to my all my junior high school years, my high school years, and going into the 80s. Mick Jones is probably one of the greatest underrated rock and roll guitar players. And Lou Gramm was one of the greatest singers, and they just had fucking more hit rock and roll songs than pretty much anybody I can think of. All things considered, I hope they get into the Hall of Fame.
These guys, they must have been so young when we were doing our thing. I mean, we're in our mid-70s now, some of us nearly 80. Well, not me, but I'm 76. Some of us are in better shape than others, let's be honest. As you get older, things do occur that you don't want to occur. I have a slight issue with balance at times when I'm on stage because I'm thinking about playing. So when all these guys are running around all over the stage around me, I just go, sorry, guys, I can't do that. I have to stand at the microphone and be here. That's my place. But it's like they're fine with that.
Just keep it steady. You're the bass player. Keep it steady, man.
That's right. That's what I do. I know my limits. You know, that's it. It's a lovely space to be on that stage. We've got such a great catalogue of songs, which is really what kept everything going for us all the way through. Mick and Lou wrote great songs. There's no denying it. I mean, when you look at the crowd when we're on stage and they know every word to every song we play, and it's heartwarming to see that. It really is. And people say to me, why are you looking so happy? I said, well, why wouldn't you be happy to see this reaction to your music?
So being inducted into the Rock Hall, it's definitely significant. I know some artists say they don't, you know, it didn't matter so much to them, but it's significant.
We think it's an honor. That's how we see it, an honor. And we are thrilled because we felt for a long, long time that we deserved it and we earned because of what we achieved. You know, this, what, 80 million albums plus worldwide sold, 16 top 30 hits. We're up there with your Fleetwood Mac and Journey, people like that. As an achievement, I think, to us it would mean a lot to be joining up peers who are already in the Hall of Fame. And so we can say, okay, brother, I'm with you. You know, we're with you.
Okay, there's this David Gilmour solo album that you're on. You have Pink Floyd. But you played with him before Pink Floyd. Can you touch on that story, on how you got associated with David Gilmour and touring with him at the very onset of your musical career? We talked about album covers.
That's me on the left by the door there. That's the first photo we took in Cambridge when David asked me to join him to do the next thing in his life. And what happened was he had a band called Joker's Wild in Cambridge. And there was a guy called Jonathan King at university at the time who had a big hit with Everyone's Gone to the Moon. I don't know if you've ever heard of Jonathan King, but he was a pop star of the era, but he was also at college. He took a shine to David because David was a very good-looking boy. I mean, he really was. And also a very, very talented guitarist. We could see where he was going because he never put the guitar down, just wanted to play, play, play. And he's one of the best guitarists in the world, without a doubt. One night, we were playing the Victoria Ballroom in Cambridge, in fact. He said, I'd like you to meet some people I know in London. He said, well, who? He said, well, Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, and Andrew Oldham, the Stones manager. Dave said, really? You know them? He said, oh, yeah, I know those guys. So Dave said, okay, let's do it. Let's go. So he took Dave to London, and they met. And they both said, look, Dave, we think you've got a chance at being a really big one day in this world. We want to send you away, but you have to choose the guys you want to work with, because we're going to send you abroad to start off. And this was 1966, a long, long time ago. I think I was 18. I think David was 19. We went up to London because I really wanted to get away from Cambridge. I'd done everything I could in Cambridge with my local bands myself. And at first, you know, it was pretty hard because Willie had a car So we used to sleep in his car most nights, actually. Well, I did, and he did. Dave had friends who we could stay with. And then they sent us off to Spain on the train. I mean, God, what a journey that was in those days. From London to Dover. Dover across to France to Calais. Calais to Paris. Paris down to the south of France, and then into Spain to Madrid. And from Madrid then down to the south of Spain to Malaga. And then along to Marbella. And we were told we were going to be playing at a brand new hotel in Marbella by the swimming pool to the guests. Well, we got there and the hotel hasn't been built. It was just a concrete slab on the floor, basically. I said, oh, great. Where were we supposed to play? All the way there, our gear was with us as well. We had our amplifiers, our Vox amplifiers, Willie's drums. We got across to France. That was the last we saw of our equipment for about a week because, you know, we had to go through customs and all that stuff. And we had to get on the next train to go to Paris. And honestly, I mean, it was such an adventure, but we were only young. We didn't care. It was exciting. We were kids, you know, just having great time. It was all relevant to what we were going to want to do in life, to be a musician and be in a band. And we did it for a year and a half. We eventually moved from Spain to France and lived in Paris. That's where I first met Mick Jones. Because he was working with Johnny Halliday. Johnny Halliday was the French Elvis, basically.
Yeah.
Huge. And Mick was his musical director and guitarist. Mick came and checked us out, Dave, me and Willie, in a club called the Bilboquet. We were playing there every night for very little money. I think we earned about 50 francs each. It was about $12 a night, you know, each. Not much. Enough to feed yourself and basically a sandwich and a beer. You know, that was about it. You know, that was the first time I met, and we got on well. And I watched what he was doing. I saw what he was doing in New York because I was playing with Peter at the time. I saw he was, you know, playing with Leslie West and people, and then he enjoyed Spooky Tooth. But he wanted to form his own band because he had this idea about a musical idea that he had of where he wanted to take his music. And he convinced Bud Prager to back him to do it and then started choosing the musicians. I think, first of all, Ian McDonald from King Crimson came into the picture. He was living in New York. Fantastic band, King Crimson were. Have you ever saw them? They were a very, very good band.
Oh, yeah.
Then he found Al Greenwood, the keyboard player. Again, extremely talented keyboard player. Lovely, lovely man. Dennis Elliott came into the picture, who was there with Ian Hunter when he came over from England. And gradually they found Lou Graham. Someone told them about this guy up in Rochester, New York. He said, you've got to listen to this guy's voice. And Mick liked it a lot. He said, you've got to come down to New York and audition. And that's where the song Long, Long Way From Home comes from. That's Lou's story. He wrote that lyric. Mm. You know, it was a Monday, a day like any other day. I left the small town for the Apple in Decay, New York.
Huh. It all comes together. Are you a U.S. citizen now, or what's your...
No, I'm still English. I am a green card permanent resident of the United States and have been since 1984. I love living in America. I really do. I mean, to me, it's home.
Yeah.
I went back to the UK about a year and a half ago to see friends and family. My daughter still lives in Cambridge in England. It had changed. Something's changed in England. I don't really know what it is, but it's not the same as it used to be. We both looked at each other, my wife and I, and she said, let's get back to America. We missed it, you know, because life here, we are very fortunate, obviously, because of what's happened in our lives, is so good. And people are so nice who we meet. You know, they often ask, you know, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a musician. They said, oh, really? Who are you with? I said, foreigner. Oh, my God. You know, it's like, they can't believe it.
Right, yeah.
So it's really a nice feeling of warmth because they're so respectful. They're never rude about it. It's just wow, we love your music, you know. So what's not to like?
It's so fun.
Come on.
It's so fun. But I mean, like back in 81, if you say the name Foreigner, you get, oh, Foreigner, the parents of the kids would be like, oh, that music. And now, you know, everyone is this age and like, you know, just these warm, like Frank Sinatra type feelings, like, oh, Foreigner. That was my first dance was A Girl Like You, you know, when I was in middle school, you know?
So many people have used it at their weddings and stuff like that. You know, it's just one of those songs. It's just, you know, it says a lot, doesn't it? I've been waiting for a girl like you, you know, I mean, come on. But yeah, it's just, I think that's the main thing. We were never a band that was known for our looks or our faces. It was the music.
Yeah.
And that's what's kept it going for so long.
That's what we want to hear about the music we love, because it is just a feeling for us. It's sometimes hard to put into words as a listener and a fan.
Thank you so much. That's lovely to hear you say that, Holly. It really is. Thank you. We worked hard in the studio to get things the way we wanted it to be so that we could present it and be proud of it, basically. We were. And I always thank the audience for being such stalwart fans of the band and staying with us and coming out, filling arenas, filling halls. And it means a lot to us. It really does. We're so thankful that they still love the music. And I hope that carries on. And next year we've agreed to do 40 more shows in the summer. But I don't know if we'll all do it. Some of us will. Al and I are more prepared than anybody to do it. We like doing it. It gets us out of the house for a few days, you know, to be allowed to have a bit of fun.
You look like you're having fun.
Well, we love having a bit of fun. I mean, you know, Bruce Watson, Michael Bluestein, Chris Fraser, the drummer, and now Louis, the new guitar player who came in. They're such lovely, lovely guys. They really are to hang out with, you know. When we've got a day off after a show, you know, that night we'll tell a few stories, have a few laughs. What's not to like, you know?
Yeah. And how
is lucky boys?
How was your first fan, Dennis Elliott, like health wise, his back, or you know, like drummers?
He's great.
Yeah,
Dennis still play great. I mean, he really does. I mean, he always says, "Well, I haven't played for a while." I said, "Dennis, you could play if you haven't played for 10 years. I know you how he plays because he's a great drummer." So I hope he does more. He doesn't like traveling so much these days as he used to. I mean, that's one of those. The downside to being in a rock band on tour is the travel, you know. But these days we've got to the point where private planes have come back into our lives. So they do travel on a private plane now. We don't use buses anymore because we can afford not to have to do that. Because the buses, especially when you've got like a 600, 800 mile trip sometimes between cities, that's a killer. And you've been traveling all night. Check into the hotel at some godly hour at 6 a.m. You go to bed, everybody else is getting up. Doors are banging, you know, maids are knocking on your door saying, "Can we clean your room?" Yeah. Well, you can just imagine the response to that, you know. No, you can't. Anyway, listen, it's been great talking to you guys. It really has.
Appreciate it.
Okay, buddy. Awesome.
All right. Okay. Cheers.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks. Take care. You too.
Okay,
right.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. All right, Holly, did you vote for Rick Wills of Foreigner? Did he make a good case? He's campaigning. He's doing his get out the vote. Are you rooting for Foreigner?
I am rooting for Foreigner. Even before we talked to Rick Wills, I definitely think they deserve a place in the Rock Hall. And you, Dave, was he in your vote today?
Foreigner, yes. And Peter Frampton. That's a good 1-2 punch right there. Yeah. Boom, boom. All I do, I remember roller skating to A Girl Like You. Actually, this song is for couples only. That's when I got off the roller skating rink.
Roller skating, yes. Yeah.
And then I went to go play Defender.
Or Asteroids.
Yeah. I don't need to be with couples only. No, that's fine. I want to play some video games. So it's time for me.
It's intentional. You just had to ward the girls off before you could go play video games.
I don't need that stress in my life.
Good call on your part.
Yeah.
Save that for later.
No, it still gives me, I'm tensing up already.
Just the idea of
just the idea of like, yeah. about a dance. No. Oh, my God. I'm getting PTSD. Okay. I don't think I mentioned on the podcast, but the Foreigner was my second concert I went to. I won tickets on KFI, and I got to see them play their Double Vision tour in 1978. Saved me. As I looked back, I found the actual ad that they had in the newspaper. It saved me $7.50, this ticket, because that's how much it was to go to an arena show back in 1978.
What would the service charge have been on the $7.50 ticket?
It would have been 50 cents, so you probably would have had to pay $8.
Well, that is a big savings for a kid of 13 years old.
Yes, it was Foreigner with special guest star Walter Egan, Wednesday, October 25th. Oh, $9.75 was the most expensive seat. I don't know if we had that. It was $9.75, $8.75, and $7.75. Tickets available at Forum, Box Office, Mutual Ticketron, and ChargeLine. You know what the great part is? This was sponsored by KMET. It was also, you know, because it was October 25th. What is October?
Rocktober.
That's right. It's a Rocktober at KMET with Foreigner, special guest star Walter Egan.
He of Magnet and Steel.
He of Magnet and Steel fame. Like, as a 12-year-old, going into the men's bathroom at the Forum on October 25th, that was quite an experience, too.
You had a contact high.
I must have. That was terrifying for me at the time. Everything was terrifying for me. I was constantly terrified.
Girls.
Girls.
Couple skating. People smoking pot.
Rock music. The KMET crowd. I was my mom put the fear of everything into me. So it's... I don't know if that was...
She did a great job.
I don't know if that was helpful or not. I wish I had a little more courage. That's another story for another time. All right. Well, anywho.
Should we call it a day?
Good luck to Foreigner. We wish them well. I hope they get into the Rock Hall. We wish Peter Frampton. We wish Rick Wills well. I hope to see him up on stage playing with both bands. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be fun. That would be a good Rock Hall thing for them to do. I think that'll happen.
All right. Well,
should they both get in, then they will.
From your mouth. All right. Remind people about social media once more.
YouTube at What Difference Does It Make Podcast, and on other social media at WDDIM Podcast. Check us out. There's lots of good stuff there.
Always good stuff. All right. Well, good stuff's coming. So if you'd like, you can check out our website, WDDIMPodcast.com. We have a newsletter that comes out every month. It's fun. And then you can, on the website, you can also see past episodes, catch up on that. So that's nice. That's nice.
That's nice. That's nicer than nice.
All right. Well,
that's awesome.
It is. You taking care of business every day?
I think we took care of business every day.
All right. Well, until next time, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.